Case number 21-5223. Ferry Authority Services and Logistics, LLC, appellant versus United States Department of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Tolching for the appellant, Mr. Dreyer for the appellant.
Seems like you're not the big draw this morning, but we're interested nonetheless, so please proceed.
I appreciate that. So my name is Ed Tolching. I'm here representing the appellant in this case, Ferry Operative. And we're here on a FOIA. It's kind of a unique FOIA appeal, not one that I've previously handled or seen, in which we're actually trying to figure out what to do when the district court effectively decided the matter based upon a declaration we didn't see and on which we can't comment because we've never seen it. And then withheld a document under FOIA based on a secret declaration. And they didn't even see the document in camera that they were told. The district court didn't see the document in camera. So
it's not an ideal situation, but I mean, we've seen a lot of FOIA cases, and it's not that unusual to have a declaration that explains the basis for withholding without revealing the information that the government is seeking.
No question, but that declaration is then provided to physicians so that they can see it to the extent that it doesn't disclose what it is they're trying to protect. Here, we're given nothing. And that really comes down, that really is the nut of this problem. The government's justification for what happened here is that Hubbard, United States versus Hubbard, which is the lodestar of what to do, doesn't apply.
Let me just make sure I understand what we're, Hubbard applies to a situation where you're trying to obtain, the question here is whether or not the district court properly relied on an ex parte declaration, right? You're not seeking under FOIA that declaration, correct? You're just arguing that the district court shouldn't have relied on it, right?
So that's one issue.
So this is not a Hubbard case. This is controlled by Harris.
No.
No?
I disagree.
Okay, tell me why.
Because the Tierney Declaration is a judicial record. That's why Hubbard applies.
But you're not seeking a copy of that in this case.
Well, in order to argue.
Isn't that right? I mean, you might, and then it would be a Hubbard case.
It's a two-step process. In order to argue about.
Can I just ask you, are you seeking the Tierney Declaration? No, right?
In order to argue about the two-page document, we're seeking the Tierney Declaration so that we can argue about the two-page document. It's a two-step process. We can't even begin addressing the underlying issue in this case because we haven't seen why it's being withheld.
You took Hubbard in the abstract and asked yourself how it might apply to this kind of situation where you have a FOIA requester and the government says, we need to justify the withholding, but we can't do it without letting the cat out of the bag. And you ask yourself how those six factors would apply to that kind of situation. Wouldn't you get something pretty close to ARIF anyway?
Fight.
Okay, so what are we fighting over?
But I don't think ARIF says that we don't get the Tierney Declaration. I think all ARIF says at the bottom is that you've got to look at a balance of privacy versus public. That's all it does. And I think Hubbard basically does
the same. Government doesn't dispute that.
Well, okay, but what?
So we're not talking. No, I mean, we're not talking about a legal disagreement between two noticeably different standards. We're talking about whether they met their burden of showing that they need to tell us a little bit more without revealing things that they're entitled to protect.
I think at bottom, a lot of tests that courts develop are based upon an amalgam of information and an amalgam of standards. And you can always watch them together and say, let's look at what's reasonable. And I don't disagree. ARIF is reasonableness. Hubbard is reasonableness. Hubbard sets out six factors. Area four is probably a two of the six factors. But the bottom line is that what Area said is that if you have a lot in the public already and you're just missing something, and we have got to understand as a court what it is that, why it is that we're redacting a small thing and it's not in the record, we can look at a declaration beyond what's already in the record. In this case, we have nothing. In other words, if there was a tyranny declaration that we saw, and it said whatever it said, but there was something unique that Tierney couldn't say publicly, and that was in a separate declaration, then you would have an Area type case. But here, we have nothing. We're sitting here arguing about something that we can't address because we haven't seen anything. Even in their brief, they disclosed something about the Tierney application, the Tierney declaration, which we had never known before. But when you look at it, it made the Tierney declaration an improper declaration because it was argumentative.
It does make your job harder, no doubt. But let's talk about a few things you can talk about, which is the merits, the balance on the merits. And it seems like we have a lot of authority for the proposition that a person who comes forward with information, provides information to the government, has some privacy interest in not having his or her identity just divulged within Exemption 6. You agree with that?
The case is going both ways. And I tell you what I think the difference is.
Really? What?
Holland is one very good example.
I'm sorry, which one?
Holland. We cited a whole bunch of them in our brief. And I can find it. I just saw that earlier this morning in our reply brief. But there are a lot of cases in which the U.S. District Court of the District of Columbia addressed these issues.
How about from this court?
There's not much in this court. Okay. There's not much coming out of this court. But it's really all the same kind of law, because what the courts have said and with basic reason tells you is that you've got to look at something and say, is this really a privacy? How much privacy? How important is the privacy? And you look at it and say, well, this person, whoever it was that submitted this, he wasn't an anonymous complaint. He put his name on something and sent it to the U.S. government. So privacy, somewhat limited. Okay, now public. What is it that we need? We need to see how the government looked at this, and part of it is where it came from. Was it from a friend? Was it from a competitor? How do they look at that? So you look at the privacy, which is limited, and the cases have said that when somebody submits something to the government and puts their name on it, that privacy interest is extremely limited. And you look at the public need, and the public needs to figure out what the VA did.
What the government is up to is a standard phrase we use in cases. So what would this record, now you haven't seen it, but suppose it's just information, it's the allegation that your client sold defective products. That doesn't tell you how the government investigates. How would the complainant know that? He's not an inspector general reviewing the agency's investigatory process. He's a complainant saying your client sold bad products.
Oh, did the complainant come from somebody who was a competitor? You don't know. Did the complainant come from somebody? Was the complainant somebody who actually never dealt with my client? I don't know. Was the complainant somebody who has the same last name as somebody at the VA who acted on this? We don't know. We don't know anything.
So you're saying that the identity of the complainant is critical to what?
It's possible. The identity of the complainant is very important. But
it's the privacy versus your interest in the identity, and maybe you lose.
But if we had the email with that information redacted, we might say, well, we don't need. We could see what happened here. We don't need the identity because we see in the email that this person is saying, I work at a hospital and these people deliver.
But the allegation is if you see the email, it will reveal the identity, which you're not entitled to. necessarily to have.
So that's the allegation that is beyond my credulity. I don't understand how looking at an email where information is redacted, addresses and names are redacted, we will know the identity of the person who submitted it. It's just not, it just doesn't make any sense. If the person said, I'm in a hospital in, I don't know, Atlanta, Georgia. I'm in a VA hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. Okay, redact VA hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. But tell us it was a hospital. If the person says, I know that Stryker beds were what, because we think that that's what the complaint was, because we heard something in an oral conversation, or my client did. If we find out that it's really not Stryker beds, it's some other product that my client has never sold anywhere, we would be able to respond more forcefully. But the bottom line is that we know nothing. And the reason why we know nothing is because everything has been in a sealed brown bag, and we've been given no.
I mean, you're interested in the identity.
Is that?
You want to know the identity of the accuser, right?
We might. But without looking at the information, without the identity, we can't even argue why we need the identity.
You admitted in your brief that you want to know the identity. You want to unmask the
complaint? There is no question my client would like to know the identity. And the reason is because if this person is an out-and-out liar, he wants to know.
I don't blame you for that. But,
right.
I mean, let's not beat around the bush. That's what this case is about.
That's what my client would like to do.
Not
sue somebody for libel or slander, or it's probably libel, defamation.
Yeah.
But that's not harassment. That's not.
No, that's not
the privacy interest that they could, that the government can protect. The government has no right to protect somebody from a libel suit. That's just wrong. The government has the right.
Right, but it's a little bit unrealistic to then frame this as, you know, you can redact everything that bears on the identity and they release a document that, you know, says this came from a Yahoo email address.
I always tell my clients, let's go step by step. If we see a document without the identity, maybe that will be enough. If we see the document, we might need the identity. That's step two. But without looking at anything, it's like arguing about ambiguities. We have nothing.
Don't you want a redacted version so that your client can try to piece together what the identity is? And isn't the government's position that we don't know what your client knows, so if we reveal any of this, they might be able to unmask?
I'll answer that in two ways.
Okay.
No, there are two steps, and I would tell people there are two steps. Let's look at the document without it, so that there's nothing that would possibly identify the person. That would be step one. Let's look at the tyranny declaration as to why they say they can't do that. That would be a certain part of the step. And two would be the answer is that if we want that information, it's because we have a legitimate interest. It's not an illegitimate interest. All the cases that they cite about harassment, they know we want to harass this person, are all about their abortion clinic protesters who want to go in and beat up women who are going into an abortion clinic. Or physicians often, it's that kind of harassment that the cases are concerned about. They're never concerned about. In fact, this court has said we're not concerned about potential lawsuits or potential litigation that might develop. That's legitimate harassment if you want to look at it that way. But it's nothing that should prevent us from looking at this information. But again, we haven't seen the Tierney Declaration. We haven't seen any part of this email. We're talking about nothing. That's what we have, nothing. And that really is what this comes down to. Can the U.S. District Court decide a case based upon not giving us any information?
Thank you, Judge Tatel. Any questions? Judge Pan, anything else?
No, thank you.
Thank you. We'll give you some time.
Good morning. May it please the court, Douglas Dreyer on behalf of the Department of Veterans Affairs. There are two issues here. First, the district court acted comfortably within its discretion when it accepted the Tierney Declaration ex parte. And second, VA appropriately withheld the complaint under Exemption 6 for the reasons stated, not just under seal in the Tierney Declaration, but in the three public-facing declarations in this case. FOIA does not compel agencies to unmask a whistleblower. in a case like this one.
Let's talk about that. Put aside the information in the ex parte declaration for now, which might present case-specific issues. I mean, just as a general matter, you do have cases on your side saying there is a privacy interest in, you know, complainants have some privacy interest in their identity. But is there any requirement that that be a legitimate privacy interest? And I mean, suppose the person coming forward is a competitor with malicious intent who makes a false charge and substantially harms the FOIA plaintiff here. And sure, they want to bring a defamation action, but be a perfectly good action.
So the privacy interest must stay focused on the interest of protecting the identity of the individual complainant. And there could be good, significant public interest reasons why the identity of a complainant should be disclosed. Perhaps there's less of an incentive to protect protect the identity of an individual who's submitted a malicious complaint. But I want to emphasize that's not the case that's here today. So in the answer, for instance, the defendant denied that the complaint was false. The defendant has certainly never conceded that there is a false complaint here. And also, I think where the focus has been is on the investigation eventually lifted the recall. But that is not in any sense a determination that the initial complaint itself is false. I also would like to focus on the particular request at issue here, because I do think the words matter. And the words particularly matter in this case, where my friend narrowed the FOIA request. So on page 15 of the joint appendix, the request is narrowed to, quote, the redacted form of the two-page document, i.e. not the substance, and the identity of the person or entity submitting the complaint. That is all that is being sought here. And so it's directly contrary to what we were hearing earlier in the argument about what the reasons. They explicitly disclaimed it, seeking just the identity of the person. And so that's really what we're here today on.
So I had a question about the Tierney Declaration. And so the case law says that a district court relying on in-camera submissions must make its reasons for doing so clear and make as much as possible of the in-camera submission available to the opposing party. And it seems that there was a request both in the motion for reconsideration and in the prior brief in the court below to at least give us some of this. And it seems to me that the district court did not address the option of redacting the Tierney Declaration and giving some of it to the FOIA requester. And so I'm wondering if that's an abuse of discretion where the court says it must make as much as possible available to the opposing party, and it has to make its reasons for doing so clear. I don't see any explanation that it was considered redacting the Tierney Declaration and giving some of it to the opposing party.
So I think what's important here is that the defendant filed a motion for leave to file the Tierney Declaration ex parte. And in that motion, it provided significant contents about the Tierney Declaration. And that's not in the joint appendix, but it is ECF number 12, I believe, perhaps 10. It's either 10 or 12, sorry. But in that motion, it identifies the name of the declarant, it identifies the title of the declarant, and it provides what defendant was able to say in a public-facing setting. And so the district court gets presented with this motion, with that information already on the record. And I would read the last two pages of the district court's opinion where it addresses this issue as really saying that, look, this information, to the extent it should be disclosed, it already has been in that.
Does it say that? I don't see that here.
It doesn't use those exact words. No, Your Honor.
So wasn't the court required to make its reasons for doing so clear? Those are the words of the Armstrong case. So you're coming up with a reason, but that's not what the court said. So I'm wondering if that's an abuse of discretion. And if so, is there harmless error here?
Well, I'd say, so the district court, for instance, it cited Barnard at the end of its opinion. So in the Barnard case, which is another district court opinion, the court did include the district court included a footnote explaining that it had assessed whether it could segregate any portions of the declaration and provide a public version, and determined that it could not. And I think it could be read into the citation of the Barnard decision that occurred here.
There's no parenthetical or anything about Barnard. It's just cited. So you think that's sufficient to make its reasons for doing so clear, citing Barnard?
I do hear. And I'd also submit that the motion itself is already disclosed, the disclosable, to the extent there are disclosable portions of the Tierney Declaration, those portions were submitted in the motion itself.
But there's no way for the opposing party to know that, because they don't know what's in the Tierney Declaration.
And that's, FOIA is an unusual case. And Arif pointed this out long ago, that this is really a case where the court's job is to determine whether to maintain material under seal. One party knows the contents of the withheld records while the other does not, and the courts have been charged with the responsibility of deciding the dispute without altering that unequal condition, since that would involve disclosing the very material sought to be kept secret. And so it is very difficult to provide additional information without forcing the government to concede its case in its briefing.
I think that's different from what I'm asking, because it seems to me that you could redact the Tierney Declaration to preclude disclosure of the information that might disclose the identity of the complainant. And it seemed to me that this case law suggests that the district court was required to either do that or explain why it did not.
And to that, I suppose I would say that to the extent there was any error below, it would still need to be not a harmless error. And here, since the motion itself disclosed contents of the Tierney Declaration, disclosed the name of the person, the title of the person, I don't see how any error relating to that would be harmless, would be anything but harmless.
Your position, you think you can win on the merits now. Even if we were to disregard the information in paragraph 8 of Tierney, which might help you out, but if we disregard that, we're left with some reason to think that this was a competitor, the charge was false, may have been malicious, and it caused substantial damage to the complainant. And your position is just tough.
Well, my position is that the Tierney Declaration was indeed essential to the district court's opinion and needed.
Tierney might make the case substantially different from what I just described, but I'm just testing here whether we need Tierney for you to win.
Defendant does think we need Tierney to win, and the reason why is because
thinks you do need it.
Yeah, we need Tierney to win in this case, and the reason we need that is because when the court looks at the test that was set forth in Arif and looks at the test set forth in Montgomery just this past July, one of those the requirements of that test is that the validity of the exemption you need the information being provided ex parte in order to decide the validity of the exemption. And so if I were to answer that alternatively, then the Tierney Declaration would perhaps never have, should never have been filed in the first place.
Yeah, I see that. I think you're entitled to argue in the alternative, but I appreciate your candor on that. Judge Tatel? Okay, thank you.
Counsel cited to Appendix 15 is something that limited this. But look at Appendix 15. What that is a letter from me saying, as an initial limited release. In other words, we're saying you've withheld everything, and you've withheld it on the basis of Exemption 5. They didn't even withhold it on Exemption 6. They withheld it on Exemption 5. And our position was, was if you're withholding it on exemption 5, as a limited matter, you have to at least initially give us something that's limited, because exemption 5 clearly cannot apply to what it is you're withholding. That's what that letter's about. It has nothing to do. It doesn't limit this our request. That's just wrong.
So it says in your letter, we ask that the redacted form of the 2-page document be released, not the substance.
Two paragraphs up.
And B, the identity of the person or identity submitting the complaint be released unredacted from the form document. So that does seem to be narrowing your FOIA request.
So read two paragraphs up. I am asking for a prompt initial limited release. And it goes on in the next paragraph to explain that exemption 5 cannot apply to what it is that we're asking for a limited release. And you're denying us. In other words, they said, we're not giving you anything, exemption 5. I said, well, that's crazy, because exemption 5 cannot possibly apply to this stuff. So give us the initial limited release. Then we can fight about everything else. And they wouldn't give us that either. But that doesn't limit this case. That's clearly not what's happening. The court asked us about cases in which this has occurred. People for American Away. We cited that case. We cited the case of Edelman, in which complainants, in which people writing the government letters complaining were released. Their response was, well, look at Edelman 3, because it was additional litigation in Edelman. And that's true, there was. But in Edelman 3, it said, well, we're going to withhold the last X number of names because you already have 50 other names of the complainants. And these last ones are just in the same category. So you have no real need for these names. So it's clear that releasing names is de rigueur. That's really what should have occurred here.
Thank you. Judge Tatel?
No.
Judge Pan? Okay, thank you. The case is submitted.